Chapter 4. Architecture of Emotional and Psychosomatic Disorders, Part 1. In order to comprehend the extensive implications that the study of holotropic states has had for understanding emotional and psychosomatic disorders, we must first examine the conceptual frameworks that are currently used in psychiatry. The attempts to explain the nature and origin of psychiatric disorders fall into two broad categories. Some academics and clinicians show a strong preference to see these disorders as resulting from causes that are primarily of biological nature, while others favor psychological explanations. In everyday clinical practice, psychiatrists also often choose an eclectic approach and assign different degrees of significance to elements from both categories, leaning to one side or the other of the argument. The organically oriented psychiatrists believe that, since the psyche is a product of material processes in the brain, the final answers in psychiatry will come from neurophysiology, biochemistry, genetics, and molecular biology. According to them, these disciplines will one day be able to provide adequate explanations as well as practical solutions for most of the problems in their field. This orientation is usually associated with a rigid adherence to the medical model and with attempts to develop a fixed diagnostic classification for all emotional disorders, including those for which no organic basis has been found. An alternative orientation in psychiatry emphasizes factors of a psychological nature, such as the role of traumatic influences in infancy, childhood, and later in life, along with pathogenic potentials of conflict, the importance of family dynamics and interpersonal relationships, and the impact of the social environment. In the extremes, this way of thinking is applied not only to neuroses and psychosomatic disorders, but also to those psychotic states for which medicine has no biological explanation, functional or endogenous psychoses. A logical consequence of this approach is to seriously question the appropriateness of applying the medical model, including rigid diagnostic labels, to disorders that are not biologically determined and are thus clearly of a different order than the organic ones. From this perspective, psychogenic disorders reflect the complexity of the developmental factors to which we have been exposed over the course of our life. Transpersonal psychologists would expand the spectrum of these influences to our entire psycho-spiritual history. Since these influences differ widely from person to person, the efforts to squeeze the resulting disorders into the straitjacket of medical diagnosis makes little sense. Although many professionals advocate for an eclectic approach that acknowledges a complex interplay of biology and psychology, or nature and nurture, the biological approach dominates the thinking in academic circles and routine everyday psychiatric practice. As a result of its complex historical development, psychiatry has become established as a subspecialty of medicine, which gives it a strong biological bias. Mainstream conceptual thinking in psychiatry, the approach to individuals with emotional disorders and behavior problems, the strategy of research, basic education and training, and forensic measures are all dominated by the medical model. This situation is a consequence of two important sets of circumstances. Medicine has been successful in establishing etiology and finding effective therapy for a specific, relatively small group of mental abnormalities of organic origin. It has also demonstrated its ability to control, symptomatically, many of those disorders for which specific organic etiology could not be found. The initial successes in unraveling the biological causes of mental disorders, however astonishing, were really isolated and limited to a small fraction of the problems with which psychiatry deals. The medical approach to psychiatry has failed to find specific organic etiology for problems vexing the absolute majority of its clients. Psychoneuroses, psychosomatic diseases, manic depressive disorders, and functional psychoses. The psychological orientation in psychiatry was inspired by the pioneering research of Sigmund Freud and his followers. Some of them, such as C.G. Jung, Otto Rank, Wilhelm Reich, and Alfred Adler, left the Psychoanalytic Association, or were expelled from it, and started their own schools. Others stayed within the organization, but developed their own variations of psychoanalytic theory and technique. Over the course of the 20th century, this collective effort resulted in a large number of schools of depth psychology, which differ significantly from each other in terms of their understanding of the human psyche and the nature of emotional disorders, as well as the therapeutic techniques they use. Most of these individuals have had minimal or no influence on mainstream thinking in psychiatry, and references to their work appear in academic textbooks as a historical note or even footnote. Only Freud's early writings, the work of a few of his followers, and the modern developments in psychoanalysis known as ego psychology have had significant impact on the psychiatric field. As we have seen, Freud and his colleagues formulated a dynamic classification that explains and ranks emotional and psychosomatic disorders in terms of fixation on a specific stage of the libido development and the evolution of the ego. One of Freud's major contributions was the discovery that sexuality does not start in puberty, but during nursing. The libidinal interests of the infant gradually shift from the oral zone at the time of nursing to the anal and urethral zone at the time of toilet training, and finally to the phallic zone, focus on the penis and clitoris at the time of the Oedipus and Electra complex. Traumatization, or conversely, overindulgence during these critical periods, can cause specific fixation on one of these zones. This predisposes the individual to psychological regression to this area when in the future he or she encounters serious difficulties. The understanding of psychopathology based on Freud's libido theory was summarized by German psychoanalyst Carl Abraham and graphically represented in Otto Fenichel's classic, The Psychoanalytic Theory of Neurosis. In his famous scheme, Abraham defined major forms of psychopathology in terms of the primary fixation of the libido. According to him, fixation on the passive oral stage, before teething occurs, predisposes the individual to schizophrenia and plays a critical role in the development of alcoholism and narcotic drug addiction. Fixation on the oral sadistic or cannibalistic stage, after teething, can lead to manic depressive disorders and suicidal behavior. The primary fixation for the obsessive compulsive neurosis and personality is on the anal level. Anal fixation also plays an important role in the genesis of so-called pregenital conversions, such as stammering, psychogenic tics, and asthma. These disorders are characterized by an obsessive-compulsive personality structure, but use the mechanism of hysterical conversion for the formation of symptoms. Urethral fixation is associated with shame and fear of blunder, and a tendency to compensate for it through excessive ambition and perfectionism. Anxiety hysteria, various phobias, and conversion hysteria, paralysis, anesthesia, blindness, loss of voice, and hysterical attack result from a fixation on the phallic stage. This aspect of psychopathology was elaborated in great detail in the later development of psychoanalysis. Modern ego psychology, inspired by the groundbreaking work of Anna Freud and Heinz Hartmann,
revised and refined classical psychoanalytic concepts and added some important new dimensions. Combining direct observations in infants and young children with a deep knowledge of psychoanalytic theory, René Spitz and Margaret Mahler laid the foundations for a deeper understanding of the ego development and establishment of personal identity. Their work brought attention to the importance of the evolution of object relationships and the difficulties associated with them. Carl Abraham's scheme took into consideration not only the points of libidinal fixation, but also fixation on the stages of the ego's evolution, from autoeroticism and primary narcissism to the establishment of object love. The description and definition of three phases in the evolution of the ego, the autistic, symbiotic, and separation individuation phase, have important theoretical and clinical implications. Margaret Mahler, Otto Kernberg, Heinz Kohut, and others expanded Carl Abraham's scheme by adding several disorders that, according to them, have their origin in the early disturbances of object relations: autistic and symbiotic infantile psychoses, narcissistic personality disturbance, and borderline personality disorders. This new understanding of the dynamics of ego evolution and its vicissitudes also made it possible to develop techniques of psychotherapy for psychiatric patients in these categories who cannot be reached by methods of classical psychoanalysis. There is no doubt that ego psychologists improved, refined, and expanded the psychoanalytic understanding of psychopathology. However, they share the superficial understanding of the psyche with classical psychoanalysis, which is limited to postnatal biography and the individual unconscious. The observations from the study of holotropic states of consciousness show that emotional and psychosomatic disorders, including many states currently diagnosed as psychotic, cannot be adequately understood solely from difficulties in postnatal development, such as problems in the development of the libido or vicissitudes involving the formation of object relations. The attempts of Freud and his followers to understand emotional and psychosomatic disorders were groundbreaking and generally moving in the right direction. However, because they were using narrow models of the psyche that were limited to postnatal biography and the individual unconscious, the explanations remained superficial and unconvincing. At times, they were even highly questionable, such as Freud's theory of the death instinct, thanatos, Ottakar Kuchera's attempt to explain sadomasochism as a fixation on the active oral stage of libido development in which the infant hurts himself or herself during aggressive attempts to bite with the newly grown teeth, or interpretation of suicide as killing the introjected bad breast. More recent editions of the American Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM-3 through 5, abandoned etiological considerations altogether and moved to simple descriptions of symptoms, the neo-Kraepelinian approach. The new, vastly expanded model of the psyche that has emerged from the research of holotropic states of consciousness makes it possible to continue the etiological quest of the psychoanalytic pioneers in the same direction and offer a much deeper and more convincing understanding of emotional and psychosomatic disorders. It also opens up exciting new perspectives for therapy. According to the new insights, these conditions have a multi-level, multi-dimensional structure with important roots in the perinatal and transpersonal levels of the unconscious. The recognition of the perinatal and transpersonal roots of emotional disorders does not mean denying the significance of the biographical factors described by psychoanalysis and ego psychology. The events in infancy and childhood certainly play an important role in the overall picture. However, instead of being the primary causes of these disorders, the memories of traumatic events from postnatal biography function as important conditions for the emergence of elements from deeper levels of the psyche. What gives neurotic, psychosomatic, and psychotic symptoms their extraordinary dynamic power and specific content are complex coex constellations that are not limited to biographical layers, but reach deep into the perinatal and transpersonal domains. The pathogenic influences emphasized by Freudian analysis and ego psychology modify the content of the themes from deeper levels of the unconscious, add to their emotional charge, and mediate their access into conscious awareness. We have already seen the relationship between symptoms and the underlying multi-layer coex system comprising biographical and perinatal elements earlier in the case of Peter. The following example involves Norbert, a 51-year-old psychologist and minister who participated in one of our 5-day workshops at the Esalen Institute. During the group introduction preceding the first session of holotropic breathwork, Norbert complained about severe chronic pain in his shoulders and pectoral muscles that caused him great suffering and made his life miserable. Repeated medical examinations, including x-rays, had not detected any organic basis for his problem, and all therapeutic attempts had remained unsuccessful. Serial procaine injections had brought only brief, transient relief for the duration of the drug. He also described breathing difficulties for which no organic explanation had been found. At the beginning of the session of holotropic breathwork, Norbert made an impulsive attempt to leave the room, since he could not tolerate the music, which he felt was killing him. It took great effort to persuade him to stay with the process and to explore the reasons for his discomfort. He finally agreed, and for almost 3 hours experienced severe pains in his breast and shoulder, which intensified to the point of becoming unbearable. He struggled violently, as if his life were seriously threatened, choked and coughed, and let out a variety of loud screams. Following this stormy episode, he quieted down and was relaxed and peaceful. With great surprise, he realized that the experience had released the tension in his shoulder and muscles, and that he was free from pain. The breathwork experience also opened his respiratory pathways, allowing him to breathe much more easily. Retrospectively, Norbert reported that there were 3 distinct layers in his experience, all of them related to the pain in his shoulder and associated with choking. On the most superficial level, he relived a frightening situation from his childhood in which he almost lost his life. When he was about 7 years old, he and his friends were digging a tunnel on a sandy ocean beach. When the tunnel was finished, Norbert crawled inside to explore it. As the other children jumped around, the tunnel collapsed and buried him alive. He almost choked to death before he was rescued. When the breathwork experience deepened, he relived a violent and frightening episode that took him back to the memory of biological birth. His delivery was very difficult, since his shoulder had been stuck for an extended period of time behind the pubic bone of his mother. This episode shared the combination of choking and severe pain in the shoulder with the previous one. In the last part of the session, the experience changed dramatically. Norbert started seeing military uniforms and horses and recognized that he was involved in a battle. He was even able to identify it as one of the battles in Cromwell's England. At one point, he felt a sharp pain and realized that his shoulder had been pierced by a lance. He fell off the horse and experienced himself being trampled by the horses running over his body and crushing his chest. Norbert's consciousness separated from the dying body, soared high above the battlefield, and observed the scene from a bird's eye view. Following the death of the soldier, whom he recognized as himself in a previous incarnation, his consciousness returned to the present and reconnected with his body, which was now pain-free for the first time after many years of agony. The pain relief brought about by these experiences turned out to be permanent. We saw Norbert more than 20 years after his memorable session and found out that the symptoms still had not returned. The traumatic memory of certain aspects of birth seems to be an important component of psychogenic symptoms of all kinds. The unconscious record of the experience represents a universal pool of difficult emotions and physical sensations that constitute a potential source of various forms of psychopathology. Whether emotional and psychosomatic disorders actually develop, and which form they take, then depends on either the reinforcing influence of traumatic events in postnatal history, or on the mitigating effect of favorable biographical factors. The roots of emotional, psychosomatic, and interpersonal problems can include not only biographical and perinatal components, but also reach deep into the transpersonal domain of the psyche. They can take the form of past life experiences or of mythological figures and motifs that share the same archetypal quality. It is also not uncommon to discover that the symptoms are related on a deep level to elements drawn from the animal or botanical kingdoms. The symptoms of emotional and psychosomatic disorders are the result of a complicated interplay involving biographical, perinatal, and transpersonal elements. It is interesting to speculate what factors might be responsible for the origination of coex constellations and the relationship between their biographical layers, perinatal matrices, and transpersonal components. The similarity of some of the postnatal traumas and their resemblance to certain aspects of the perinatal dynamics might be attributed to chance. The life of some individuals might accidentally bring victimizing situations resembling BPM-2, violent or sexual traumas with elements of BPM-3. Episodes involving pain and choking, and other insults similar to perinatal distress. However, when a coex system is established, it has a self-replicating propensity and can unconsciously drive the individual to recreate situations of a similar kind and thus add new layers to the memory constellation, as we saw earlier in the case of Peter. Many people involved in deep self-exploration reported some interesting insights concerning the relationship between past life experiences and the birth trauma. The reliving of birth often coincides or alternates with various karmic episodes that share an emotional quality or certain physical sensations with it. This connection suggests the possibility that the way in which we experience our birth might be determined by our karma. This applies not only to the general nature of our birth experience, but also to specific details. Being hanged or strangled in a past life situation, for example, can translate to suffocation during birth caused by the umbilical cord twisted around the neck. Pains inflicted by sharp objects in karmic dramas can become pains caused by uterine contractions and pressures. The experience of being in a medieval dungeon, torture chamber of the Inquisition, or a concentration camp can fuse with the no-exit experience of BPM-2 and so on. Karmic patterns can also underlie and shape traumatic events in postnatal biography. Bearing in mind this history, our psychological understanding of the most important forms of psychopathology changes due to the observations made from holotropic states of consciousness. The following discussion focuses exclusively on the role of psychological factors in the formation of symptoms. This does not include the disorders that are clearly organic in nature and belong to the realm of medicine, such as those caused by tumors or fevers. Before we explore the revolutionary new understanding of specific disorders, it seems appropriate to acknowledge Freud's inquisitive and brilliant intellect. He was not satisfied with his own interpretations of many conditions in terms of traumatic experiences in infancy and childhood, and with the efficacy of the free associations method as a therapeutic tool. He even made a statement in one of his last books, An Outline of Psychoanalysis, that sounds almost like a prophetic intimation of the forthcoming psychedelic era. But here we are concerned with therapy only insofar as it works by psychological means. And for the time being, we have no other. The future may teach us to exercise a direct influence by means of particular chemical substances upon the amounts of energy and their distribution in the apparatus of the mind. It may be that there are other undreamed of possibilities of therapy. But for the moment, we have nothing better at our disposal than the technique of psychoanalysis, and for that reason, in spite of its limitations, it is not to be despised. Since modern academics and clinicians seem to have given up on the quest of Freud and his early disciples for a more plausible explanation of psychogenic disorders, I will try to demonstrate the explanatory power of the new model by expanding, revising, and deepening the original Freudian concepts. Freud's classical psychoneuroses. Most psychiatrists would probably agree that anxiety, whether in its free-floating variety, in the form of phobias involving specific persons, animals, and situations, or as a factor underlying various other symptoms and syndromes, represents one of the most common and basic psychiatric problems. Since anxiety is a response to situations that endanger survival or body integrity in nature, it makes sense that one of the primary sources of clinical anxiety is the trauma of birth, which is an actual or potentially life-threatening situation. Freud himself briefly entertained the possibility that the frightening experience of birth might be the prototype for all future anxieties. He got the idea during an examination of obstetric nurses, as mentioned in an earlier chapter. Anxiety hysteria, phobias. In classical psychoanalysis, phobias were seen as conditions that began around the age of 4 and were the result of fixation at the phallic stage of libidinal development due to a psychosexual trauma. Work with holotropic states, however, has shown that the roots of phobias reach much deeper to the perinatal level of the unconscious and often even further to the transpersonal domain. The critical role that the trauma of birth plays in the genesis of phobias is most evident in claustrophobia, the fear of closed and narrow places. From Latin, claustrum, meaning closed place, and Greek phobos, meaning fear. It manifests in confined and crowded situations, such as elevators, subways, and small rooms without windows, and leads to an urgent need to leave the confined space and seek open air. Individuals who are claustrophobic are under the selective influence of a coax system that is associated with the onset of BPM-2 when the uterine contractions begin to close in on the fetus. The biographical factors from postnatal life that contribute to this disorder are memories of situations that involve uncomfortable confinement or restriction of breathing, near drowning, respiratory diseases, immobilization by a plaster cast, and being locked in a dark space or bound, e.g. to prevent masturbation or scratching at eczema. From the transpersonal level, the elements that are most significant for this phobia are karmic memories involving imprisonment, entrapment, and suffocation. While the general tendency of claustrophobic patients is to avoid situations that intensify symptoms, a true therapeutic change requires the full experience of the underlying unconscious memories and opening of the breath through bodywork and abreaction. Agoraphobia, from Greek agora, meaning central square of a town, the fear of open places or of the transition from an enclosed space to a wide open one, seems at first to be the opposite of claustrophobia. In actuality, agoraphobic patients are typically also claustrophobic, but the transition from an enclosed place to a large open space represents a stronger emotional challenge for them than staying in the enclosed space. On the perinatal level, agoraphobia is associated with the very final stage of BPM-3, when the sudden release after many hours of extreme confinement is accompanied by the fear of losing all boundaries, being blown apart, exploding, and ceasing to exist. When they are in the open space, agoraphobic patients behave like children. They are afraid to cross the street or a large square by themselves and need support from adults and to be led by the hand. Some of them are afraid that they will lose control, take off their clothes, and lie on the ground naked, exposed to the looks of bystanders and passers-by. This is reminiscent of the situation of the newborn, who has just experienced birth and is inspected by adults. In holotropic therapy, the experience of ego death and psycho-spiritual rebirth tends to bring significant relief from this condition. Patients suffering from thanatophobia, from Greek thanatos, meaning death, or the pathological fear of death, experience episodes of vital anxiety, which they interpret as the onset of a life-threatening heart attack, stroke, or suffocation. This phobia has deep roots in the extreme physical discomfort and sense of impending catastrophe associated with the trauma of birth. The coex systems involved are typically related to situations that endanger life, such as operations, diseases and injuries, particularly those that interfere with breathing. The radical resolution of thanatophobia requires the conscious reliving of the different layers of the underlying coex system and an experiential confrontation with death. Nosophobia, from Greek nosos, meaning disease, the pathological fear of having or contracting a disease, is closely related to thanatophobia and also to hypochondriasis, an unsubstantiated delusional conviction of having a serious illness. Patients suffering from this disorder have a variety of strange body sensations that they cannot account for, and they tend to interpret them in terms of a present somatic disease. These symptoms involve pains, pressures and cramps in different parts of the body, strange energy flows, paresthesias, and other forms of unusual phenomena. They can also manifest as the dysfunction of various organs, such as breathing difficulties, dyspepsia, nausea and vomiting, constipation and diarrhea, muscular tremors, general malaise, weakness, and fatigue. Repeated medical examinations typically fail to detect any organic disorder that would explain the subjective complaints. The reason for this is that the disturbing sensations and emotions are not related to a present physiological process, but to memories of past physical traumas. Patients with these problems often repeatedly demand various clinical and laboratory tests and can become a real nuisance in doctors' offices and hospitals. Many of them end up in the care of psychiatrists, where they often do not receive the compassionate acceptance they deserve. Psychiatrists are medical doctors, and the absence of any organic basis for these patients' complaints can make them take the complaints of these patients less seriously. Physical symptoms that cannot be justified by appropriate laboratory findings are often dismissed as products of the client's imagination or even as malingering. Nothing could be further from the truth. Despite the negative medical findings, the physical complaints of these patients are very real. However, they do not reflect a current medical problem, but rather are caused by surfacing memories of various physiological difficulties from the past. Their sources are various diseases, operations, and injuries. The trauma of birth is particularly important. Three distinct varieties of nosophobia deserve special attention. Cancerophobia, the pathological fear of developing or having cancer. Bacillophobia, the fear of microorganisms and infection. And mesophobia, the fear of dirt and contamination. All these problems have deep perinatal roots, although their specific forms are biographically co-determined. In cancerophobia, from Greek cancer, meaning crab, the important element is the similarity between cancer and pregnancy. It is well known from psychoanalytic literature that the malignant growth of tumors is unconsciously identified with embryonic development. This similarity goes beyond the most obvious superficial parallel, that of a rapidly growing foreign object inside one's body. The connection can actually be supported by anatomical, physiological, and biochemical data. In many respects, the cancer cells resemble undifferentiated cells from the early stages of embryonic development. In bacillophobia and mesophobia, from Latin bacillos and Greek mesos, meaning dirt, the pathological fear focuses on biological material, body odors, and uncleanliness. The biographical determinants of these disorders usually involve memories from the time of toilet training, but their roots reach deeper, to the scatological aspect of the perinatal process. It is typically found in patients who came into contact with the mother's feces or inhaled the fetal feces, meconium, during birth. The key to understanding these phobias is the connection that exists within BPM-3 between death, aggression, sexual excitement, and various forms of biological material. Patients suffering from these disorders are not only afraid that they themselves might get biologically contaminated, but they are also frequently preoccupied with the possibility of infecting others. Their fear of biological materials is thus closely associated with aggression that is oriented both inward and outward, which is precisely the situation characteristic of the final stages of birth. On a more superficial level, the fear of infection and bacterial growth is also unconsciously related to sperm and conception, and therefore again connected to pregnancy and birth. The most important coex systems related to the above phobias involve relevant memories from the anal sadistic stage of libidinal development and conflicts around toilet training and cleanliness. Additional biographical material is represented by memories that depict sex and pregnancy as dirty and dangerous. Like all emotional disorders, these phobias often also have transpersonal components. Deep entanglement and identification with biological contaminants are also the basis of a particular kind of low self-esteem that involves self-degradation and a sense of disgust with oneself, referred to colloquially as shitty self-esteem. It is frequently associated with ritual behaviors aimed at getting rid of repulsive and disgusting material and improving one's exterior. The most obvious of these rituals is the compulsive washing of hands or other parts of the body. It can be so excessive that it results in serious injuries to the skin and bleeding. Other rituals represent efforts to avoid or neutralize the biological contamination, such as wearing white gloves, using a clean handkerchief to touch doorknobs, or cleaning cutlery and plates before eating meals. This connects this problem with obsessive-compulsive neuroses. A woman whose memory of perinatal events is close to the surface can suffer from a phobia of pregnancy and delivery. Being in touch with the memory of the birth agony makes it difficult for a woman to accept her femininity and her reproductive role because motherhood means inflicting pain and suffering. The idea of becoming pregnant and having to face the ordeal of delivery can, under these circumstances, be associated with paralyzing terror. Eikmophobia, from Greek eikme, meaning point, is a morbid fear of sharp things, such as knives, scissors, pencils, or knitting needles. This emotionally tormenting condition, which usually begins for a parent shortly after the child is born, is not a pure phobia, but involves obsessive-compulsive elements. It is a combination of violent impulses against the child, along with the fear of actually hurting it. This is typically associated with a fear of mothering, or overprotective behavior and unreasonable concerns that something might happen to the baby. Whatever the biographical determinants of this problem might be, the deeper source can be traced to the delivery of that child. This reflects the fact that the passive and active aspects of childbirth are intimately connected in the unconscious. The states of biological symbiotic union between the mother and the child represent states of experiential unity. Women reliving their own birth typically experience themselves simultaneously or alternately as delivering. Similarly, memories of being a fetus in the womb are characteristically associated with an experience of being pregnant and situations of being nursed with those of nursing. The deep roots of the phobia of mothering lie in the first clinical stage of delivery, BPM-2, when the uterus is contracting and the cervix is closed. At this time, the mother and the child are trapped in a state of biological antagonism, inflicting pain on each other. This situation tends to activate the mother's memory of her own birth, unleashing the aggressive potential associated with it and directs it toward the child. The fact that delivering a child opens experiential access to perinatal dynamics represents an important therapeutic opportunity. This is a very good time for women who have just delivered their babies to do some unusually deep psychological work. On the negative side, the activation of the mother's perinatal unconscious can result in postpartum depressions, neuroses, or even psychoses if the emerging emotions are not adequately processed. Postpartum psychopathology is usually explained by vague references to hormonal changes. This does not make much sense considering that women's responses to delivery covers a very broad range, from ecstasy to psychosis, while the hormonal changes follow a fairly standard pattern. In my experience, the perinatal memories play a crucial role in the phobias of pregnancy and mothering, as well as postpartum psychopathology. Experiential work on the trauma of birth and the early postnatal period seems to be a chosen method for these disorders. Siderodromophobia, the phobia of traveling by train and subway, from the Greek sideron, meaning iron, and dromos, meaning way, is based on certain similarities between the experience of birth and travel in these means of transportation. The most important common denominators of the two situations are the sense of entrapment and the experience of enormous forces and energies in motion without any control over the process. Additional influential elements are passing through tunnels and underground passages and the encounter with darkness. In the time of the old-fashioned steam engine, the elements of fire, the pressure of the steam, and the noisy siren conveying a sense of emergency seem to be contributing factors. For these situations to trigger the phobia, the perinatal memories must be easily available to consciousness due to their intensity and the bridging effect of the postnatal layers of the underlying coax system. A phobia that is closely related to the above is fear of traveling by airplanes. It shares the alarming sense of entrapment with the other situations, the fear of the powerful energy in motion, and the inability to have any influence on the course of events. An additional factor during bumpy flights seems to be the anxious efforts to stay in the same position and the inability to let oneself move. The lack of control seems to be an element of great importance in the phobias involving travel. This can be illustrated with the phobia of traveling by car, which is a means of transportation in which we can easily play both the role of the passenger and that of the driver. This phobia typically manifests only when we are passively driven, and not when we are in the driver's seat and can deliberately change or stop the motion. It is interesting that seasickness and air sickness are also often related to perinatal dynamics and tend to disappear after the individual has completed the death-rebirth process. The essential element here seems to be the willingness to give up the need to be in control and the ability to surrender to the flow of events, no matter what they bring. Difficulties arise when the individual tries to impose his or her control on processes that have their own unrelenting dynamic momentum. The excessive need for control in a situation is characteristic for individuals who are under a strong influence of BPM3 and related coax systems, while the capacity to surrender to the flow of events shows a strong connection with the positive aspects of BPM1 and BPM4. Acrophobia, or the fear of heights, from Greek akron, meaning peak or summit, is not really a pure phobia. It is always associated with the compulsion to jump down or throw oneself from a high place, a tower, window, cliff, or bridge. The sense of falling, with a simultaneous fear of destruction, is a typical manifestation of the final stages of BPM3. The origin of this association is not clear, but it might involve a phylogenetic component. Some animals deliver standing, and their birth can involve a significant drop, for example, the birth of a giraffe. And women in some native cultures deliver while suspended on branches, squatting, or on all fours, a la vache. This was allegedly the case when Queen Maya gave birth to Buddha, standing and holding onto a branch. Another possibility is that the moment of birth reflects the first encounter with the phenomenon of gravity, including the possibility or even an actual memory of being dropped. In any case, it is very common that people who in holotropic states are under the influence of BPM3 have experiences of falling, acrobatic diving, or parachuting. A compulsive interest in extreme sports and other activities that involve falling, parachuting, bungee jumping, movie stunts, acrobatic flying, seems to reflect the need to exteriorize the feelings of impending disaster in situations that allow a certain degree of control. The bungee cord, the string of a parachute, or involve some other forms of safeguards, termination of the fall in water. The COEX systems responsible for the manifestation of this particular facet of the birth trauma include childhood memories of being playfully tossed in the air by adults and accidents involving falling. Due to the somewhat enigmatic relationship between the phobia of heights, the experience of falling, and the final stages of birth, it may be useful to illustrate it with a specific example. It involves Ralph, a German immigrant to Canada, who many years ago had attended one of our holotropic breathwork workshops in British Columbia. Case histories related to other types of phobias can be found in my other publications. In his holotropic sessions, Ralph experienced a powerful COEX system that he felt was the cause of his serious phobia of heights. The most superficial layer of this COEX contained a memory from pre-war Germany. This was the time of a hectic military buildup and of equally hectic preparations for the Olympic Games in Berlin, in which Hitler intended to demonstrate the superiority of the Nordic race. Since the victory in the Olympics was, for Hitler, a matter of extreme political importance, many talented athletes were assigned to special camps for rigorous training. This was an alternative to being drafted into the Wehrmacht, the infamous German army. Ralph, a pacifist who hated the military, was selected for one of these camps. It was a welcome opportunity to avoid the draft. The training involved a variety of sport disciplines and was incredibly competitive. All the performances were graded, and those with the least points were sent to the army. Ralph was lagging behind and had one last opportunity to improve his standing.